everyone. My name, for those of you who don't know, is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the Skan Rosh Beit Midrash of our Beit Midrash, and I will be moderating tonight. Before we begin the program itself, we would like to thank the Rubenstein family for their continued support and friendship and inspiration to our Beit Midrash, which was dedicated in memory of Ellie's father, Bill Rubenstein. As our name indicates, Zichron Dov. So we're going to begin the program with one of Bill's grandsons, Zeke Kaplan, speaking about his grandfather for a few minutes, and then we'll begin the program itself.
Thank you, Rabbi Ziering, Rabbi Turchiner, distinguished panelists, and no doubt the many doctors and lawyers who are here tonight. I want to give a very special thank you to Rabbi Turchiner and Rabbi Ziering and all the brilliant minds that continue to make Beit Midrash Zichron Dov the impactful and vibrant kollel that it is today. I'd like to share a few memories and thoughts of my grandfather, Bela Bill Dov Rubenstein, Zichron Livracha. My fondest memories as a child were with my grandparents. Anyone who had ever been to their house felt their warmth and likely ate some of my grandmother's delicious Hungarian cooking. As a child, I would take portion after portion and drink glass after glass of ice-cold loganberry juice, which was basically just syrup that to this day I think you can only buy at No Frills at Bathurst and Wilson. Grandpa would gently voice his dissatisfaction, but would never scold or preach. He was a man who taught by example, and when I took a look at his plate, it was enough food to sustain him. No more, no less. And he would drink his room temperature glass of water after finishing his meal, something he did religiously, following the teachings of Rambam, the great Jewish thinker and physician. Yesterday's Parsha, Ki Tavo, begins with a reference to entering the land of Israel, and as our inheritance as the children of Israel. The Parsha takes note three times of Israel being the land of milk and honey. There's also a specific reference to the children of Israel being a treasure people in God's eyes and a nation that would influence other nations as well. I'm sure that most people here tonight are well aware of the incredible medical advancements and innovation that has come out of Israel. Israel may be a small country in size, but its impact on the world and mankind is nothing shy of remarkable. And so it also likely come as no surprise to learn that Israel has led and continues to lead the field of R&D in medicinal cannabis. The 86-year-old Israeli chemist Rafael Mekulam was a pioneer of medical cannabis research and is renowned for isolating the active principles of cannabis for medicinal purposes. It is no coincidence that the large majority of my grandfather's grandchildren and great-grandchildren are not here tonight because they live in Israel. And my mother, Rochelle, and sister, Alicia, also could not be here tonight, as they are at our family farm in Hillsborough, Ontario, named Bela Farm, in loving memory of our grandfather. Partnered with the Jewish environmental group Shoresh, my mother and sister are busy harvesting honey for this Rosh Hashanah for the Toronto Jewish community from our apiary of Bela's bees. Grandpa was a man of moderation, be that how much he ate, how much he slept, how much he exercised, how much he drank. A bottle of wine in his house would last weeks, if not months. After we had all had some of the kiddush wine, he would pour the remainder of his glass back in the bottle while we went to wash. Wine was a sacramental tool, not something to be used to unwind or to relax. Grandpa was also a man of modesty and humility. Never would he have imagined a vibrant kollel established posthumously in his beloved memory. And surely he would not have anticipated a panel discussion with rabbis, lawyers, and doctors on the legalization of marijuana. But this hat house is a testament to the importance and relevance of this topic. While I do not think my grandpa would have been an active advocate for the legalization of marijuana, I do believe he would support the medicinal qualities and benefits marijuana has, be that to treat epilepsy, cancer patients, PTSD, and so on. Likely the only thing that he and Bob Marley had in common was their love of everything natural. But with the legalization of marijuana can also come many medicinal benefits, but without moderation it also poses many challenges to our Jewish community and to the next generation of Canadian Jews. And with that in mind, let's begin our evening.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Zeke. All speakers should be invited to shift this height. Mine, I understand, is not me. Okay, so to begin our evening again, I'd like to thank, and the Rubenstein family, thank you for sharing your memories, Zeke. We'd also like to thank all of you for coming out. We know that, being that this is the only Sunday for programming during September, there have been many things throughout the day. There are many things going on now, and we're glad that all of you chose to spend the evening with us. And thank you as well for your support of our Beit Midrash. We are entirely community supported, and that supports our shiurim throughout the year, our medical shiurim for CME credit, our legal shiurim, our shiurim and partnerships in various shuls throughout the community, our shiurim before Yomim Tovim, our shiurim dedicated to Tanakh, our special programs, and the like. So thank you for your support and for coming to learn with us. So tonight, what we want to discuss is the problems that arise in light of the soon-to-be legalization of marijuana in Canada. For the most part, the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, has been able to hide behind our celebrated principle of Dina de Malchuta Dina, that we respect the laws of the state, and since it was illegal to engage and use recreational marijuana, if someone asked a rabbi, is it permitted, a rabbi could just say, it's illegal, and because it's illegal, it is forbidden, it's usur. But now that we can't hide behind that that barrier, so to speak, we have to engage with the question, because in just a few short months, from the vantage point of Dina de Malchuta, from the vantage point of law, it will be permitted to engage and use recreational marijuana with all of the precautions that the country and the provinces are planning on setting up. But it forces us to ask the fundamental question, what does halakha have to say about the use of mind-altering drugs, substances? Is marijuana different in any substantive way, pardon the pun, from alcohol? What is, to be fair, the perspective of halacha on alcohol? And it forces us really to ask that fundamental question. So to that end, the format for tonight will be as follows. We're going to begin with a 7 or so minute introductory remarks by each of our three speakers, followed by two more rounds. The first round dealing with general questions of harm reduction in the community that will, and we'll get into the details of the question that are introduced with the legalization of marijuana. And then in the next round, we will focus on the problems that may arise specifically in the Jewish community. At the end, we'll open up the floor to questions. Throughout, there will be pads of paper being passed around by our two avreichim, by Aaron Peretz and Adam Friedman, who are over there. And at the end, we'll bring up the pads to me, and I'll pick some of the questions. If your questions aren't chosen, I'm sorry. I don't know how many questions there are going to be, and we will run out of time, but we don't like going over time, so we'll take a few questions as much as time will allow. So now I'm just going to introduce the speakers, and then you can hear from them and not me. So our first speaker will be Barry Pakis. Dr. Barry Pakis is a public health specialist physician who also works in primary care and emergency medicine. He's a Royal College Fellow in Public Health and Preventative Medicine, has an MPH from Harvard School of Public Health, a diploma in tropical medicine, and a PhD in public health ethics from the University of Toronto. He has experience working globally in northern communities with the WHO Ethics Group, and most recently as Deputy Chief Medical Officer of Health at Nunavut. He is currently the Program Director of the Public Health and Preventative Medicine Residency Program at the Dalhousie School of Public Health, the Global Health Lead for Postgraduate Medical Education at the University of Toronto, and is Associate Medical Officer of Health for Middlesex London Health Unit. Matthew Friedberg has been a criminal defense lawyer his entire career. He has successfully represented thousands of clients charged with every type of criminal offense at every level of court in Ontario. Mr. Friedberg regularly represents individuals charged with extremely serious offenses, and many of his cases have been the subject of media attention. He has had particular success defending persons charged with homicide, sexual assault, domestic assault, drug and firearms offenses. Every case is handled with the same skill and determination, with the sole aim being to achieve the most positive result possible for the client. He enjoys a reputation as a leading defense lawyer in the Toronto area. And Rabbi Mordechai Tarchiner, a Rosh Beit Midrash, was ordained by Yeshiva University in 1997, served as the rabbi of the Young Israel of Pawtucket, Rhode Island for 4 years, and then Congregation Sons of Israel in Allentown, Pennsylvania for 8 years. Rabbi Tarchiner has been our Beit Midrash since our founding in August 2009. Rabbi Tarchiner enjoys blending different areas of knowledge with Torah and utilizing diverse methods to develop curricula in Jewish history, Tanakh, and Jewish law. More than 1,500 recordings of Rabbi Tarchiner's Urim delivered in Toronto or featured on YU Torah for those who would like to see them afterwards. While in Allentown, Rabbi Tarchiner assisted in effort that created the local chapter of JAC. The subject of substance abuse is therefore very important to him. And with that, we start with our first speaker, Dr. Barry Packer. I'm just going to advance this soon. This has to go on.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here, and thank you to Rabbi Tarchiner for inviting us and for Rabbi Ziering for the introductions. My job here is really just to provide a very brief introduction. I know that there are a lot of physicians, lawyers in the crowd, and probably a couple people who are materially interested in the topic for other reasons, which might lead to a little bit of controversy. So, and I certainly don't want that to be really the focus of today's discussion. In my opinion, the most interesting bit is the halachic bit. So I'm going to just try to be fairly superficial. Certainly in preparing for this, or once the article in the CGN become public, people, you know, kept coming up to me with a simple question: are you for and against? And obviously, it's a little more complicated than that. But after explaining that for 2 or 3 minutes, people would just ask again: are you for or against? So I'm going to give a couple of little nuances why this may be a little bit more complicated from a medical perspective, and most importantly, I think from a public health perspective. Oops, I forgot to start a timer. So just a little anecdote. So I was the Deputy Chief Medical Officer of Health in Nunavut. It was a couple of months ago up in Arctic Bay, which is about 4,000 kilometers north of here, speaking to a community health group, the Hamlet Council, really, about tobacco, the rates of tobacco use up there in the 70s or 80%. And the elders really didn't want to speak to me about tobacco. They were really most concerned about marijuana use. And the reason for that is that despite tobacco killing half of the people that use it, 6 million people a year, and there are over 1 billion users around the world, what they saw in their community, what the elders saw, was the impact that marijuana use, 60 to 70% of the youth were users of marijuana there. It's much easier to get than alcohol, because alcohol is heavy. To fly all over there is quite difficult. And what they saw is the personality changes, the amotivational syndrome, the psychosis, all kinds of other things that I'll sort of allude to later on. But this idea that cannabis is dramatically less dangerous than the other substances that are out there, it is factually true in many ways, but in other ways, cannabis use can manifest itself in some pretty dangerous and acute ways as well, and that we don't see generally in the South, as anything below the Arctic Circle is called. But you do see in other places where cannabis use is much higher in youth, and that it can be expected that it is going to go a little bit higher. In fact, Canada has the highest rates of youth marijuana use at 27% of grade 7 to 12 year olds in the world. And about 40% of those between the ages of 18 and 29 have been used in the past year. So, you know, it is a reasonably common thing, you know, mostly not used that regularly, but it is certainly out there and become more prevalent. So, very basically, tetrahydrocannabinol is the active ingredient in marijuana, which is what causes the euphoria and all the things that people like about smoking it. And smoking it is actually a critical element here, because combustible, whether it's tobacco use or cannabis use, is where a lot of the ill health effects will come from. So, you know, if you're smoking marijuana regularly like you would tobacco, there are going to be a lot of the, whether it's cancer-causing, COPD, chronic obstructive lung disease, you're going to have many of the similar effects, although less so because you're not going to be smoking as often, usually, as you would smoke cigarettes, but even more so because there's not a filter, as there are with tobacco cigarettes, although there certainly could be with in the future if they were to be marketed that way. In general, there are some differences with cannabis. It's lipophilic, meaning it goes into fat, so you can't test it in the blood as easily. So all of those dynamics around impairment that we'll talk about a little bit later as well, how you test impairment, what that's going to mean in terms of motor vehicle collisions, occupational issues, people, you know, going to work stoned and going and driving stoned. You can test it in the blood. You can find it in the blood, rather, almost 2 weeks after or even longer after it's been used. And so how do you actually determine when someone is impaired or not? And another little interesting pharmacokinetic bit is that when you test it, or when it's found in the saliva or the blood, when it peaks in the saliva or the blood, it's probably not quite yet peaked in the brain, just because it crosses the blood-brain barrier quite slowly. So actually, when the levels are going down in the blood, it's actually still going up in the brain. So that's a little bit of a challenge there. Is it addictive? Lots of people are going to differ on that. There's no question there's psychological addiction to the euphoric effects. Different people respond differently. When you've been a heavy user and you quit using immediately, there are physiological effects as well. Irritability and lack of sleep, a number of other unpleasant physiological effects, nowhere close to what you would get with opioids, with heroin or similar substances, but similar to what you might get from quitting smoking, perhaps. A couple of other things in terms of addictive potential. Many people say it's nowhere near addictive as alcohol or tobacco or cocaine or heroin, which is true, but somewhere around 9-10% of people do become regular users after single use. So that number is about 30-some percent with tobacco. It's about 15% with alcohol, about 20-some percent with heroin and cocaine. So it is less addictive than those substances, but when a huge proportion of the population is going to be using, then you've got a lot more people who are going to become regular users, and therefore, you know, problems can certainly arise. How am I doing in terms of... 2 minutes, okay. Does it cause impairment? Yes. We don't have to go into it, but there's no question that it does. The degree of impairment, how they're going to test for it, those things are being worked out right now. A couple of other things that are really important to note. So when I mentioned to my mother, who was sitting over there, who both my parents are psychiatrists, and many other folks in the psychiatric field, including the chief psychiatrist in Nunavut, one of the things that always comes up is psychosis. And there are an awful lot of people who are on antipsychotics, actually, who are youth. And while it hasn't been causally associated necessarily in those groups, it has been, you know, associated generally with psychotic breaks, whether it's people who are using marijuana are more likely to, you know, have schizophrenia under psychosis, or whether there's a causative effect is not entirely clear, although most of the studies indicate that there is some association. And certainly before I was in medical school, I did some study at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, the Clark Institute, and looking at schizophrenic men who are in very high doses of medication, looking through their charts, and every single one of them had been a very heavy marijuana user, like literally every single one. And so that is out there. That is an important effect. It's not entirely known how that's going to affect things, but when it, you know, as I said, when it's more prevalent in the population, we're probably going to be seeing more of that. I think, just to end, the key issue that people often talk about with marijuana legalization or decriminalization is, aside from harm reduction, which we'll get to, is why don't we just treat it like alcohol and tobacco? And that's a reasonable thing to say, but, you know, as I alluded to before, I think it's really important to recognize that the two substances that cause the most death and devastation on the planet are the two legal substances. So there are more than 2 million alcohol users in the world, and 4 million deaths every year, and untold disability and injury related to it. And smoking, you know, as I mentioned as well, there are 1.2 million smokers in the world and 6 million deaths. Almost 10% of the deaths in the world can be directly attributed to smoking. So if our goal is to create a legalization framework that is very similar to alcohol and tobacco when it comes to cannabis, you know, that sounds reasonable on the face of it, but there's a lot of work to do to make sure that we don't go in the same direction with that. So I think I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. We'll now move on to Matthew Friedberg.
Good evening, everyone. This should serve as a reminder to me that next time I provide biographical information to somebody to read out the promotional content first from my website. But I'm not a legal historian, but marijuana has been with us truly since time immemorial. It's been with us for thousands of years. Just a little bit of background. As far back as the 1600s, the U.S. government, or perhaps the British government, was encouraging the farming of hemp, so much so that in Virginia, every farmer was required to grow hemp, and in some states was actually accepted as legal tender for some time. During the farming of hemp, actually, first until the Civil War, until it was replaced by other products, but continued to be openly sold as medicines on the open market. Hashish also became a fad in France and the U.S. in the 19th century. Only in 1906 did United States legislation require marijuana to actually be put on labels. And as we know, many drugs, as they are illegal now, have been with us for quite some time. I'm sure many of you know that Coca-Cola, the Coke in Coca-Cola, was actually cocaine. And it was removed from Coca-Cola, I think, around the 1920s. But these drugs have been with us for quite some time. As it turns out, marijuana started to become really negatized, so to speak, around after the Mexican Revolution, around 1910, when many Mexican immigrants moved north or into the United States and brought marijuana with them as a recreational drug. And at that point, anti-immigration sentiment and propaganda created fear-mongering, connecting crime to marijuana use, which was also, I suppose, racist at the time. And it also associated marijuana use with black culture as well. And we've heard things of the marijuana menace. Later on in the 40s and 50s, reefer madness. This all comes from a stigmatization of marijuana with certain cultures and people. As we progressed into the 1930s with the Depression and increased resentment against immigration and immigrants who were, I guess, became to be seen as socially inferior, there was a flurry of what we would call research at the time to connect deviant behavior with marijuana. And certainly by 1931, 29 states had criminalized marijuana. Notwithstanding that, by World War II, their U.S. Government had what called a program called Hemp for Victory program, because handing out seeds and deferring the drafts to farmers who would stay in farm hemp because they needed it for rope and parachutes for the war. In Canada, marijuana was not criminalized until 1908 with the opium. Until 1923. It was amending the 1908 Opium Act, which first criminalized opium as a result of Chinese immigrants coming to the West Coast and using opium at the time. In 1923, Mackenzie King, for some reason, the research is scant as to why he did so, decided to criminalize marijuana with an amendment to the Opium Act. It's interesting to note that marijuana was not a problem at the time. There weren't a lot of chronic heavy pot smokers in the 20s. Certainly there was a very strong temperance movement, as we all know, in the 20s. In Ontario, it had its own temperance legislation from 1916 to 1927. Of course, even today, and those were downloaded to municipalities, as some of you may know and remember, the Junction in Toronto was actually a dry section of Toronto until the year 2000, and Moose Factory, where Dr. Pacus may have visited in his travels on his work, is still a dry part of Ontario. Having said all that, few Canadians were really involved in marijuana until the 1960s, and the counterculture started to become prevalent. And it was only in the 1960s that many Canadians found their way into the criminal justice system through marijuana charges, when thousands upon thousands of people started to become charged with marijuana. At that time, people started to go to jail for possessing marijuana joints. And in 1972, some may remember, the LaDain Commission published a very, very detailed report on the non-medicinal use of drugs and marijuana and recommended decriminalization. And of course, our government, as it often does react to royal commissions, decided to shelve that and keep on prosecuting people for the next 30 or 40 years. So notwithstanding all that, there were a lot of developments in the last 17 years. The Ontario Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada began to deal with marijuana, medicinal marijuana. I'm not going to take you through the rulings and bore you to tears, but we got to a point where the Trudeau government, and I'm simply speculating, it may have something to do with Trudeau's mother and mental health and drug use, but the Trudeau government that we voted into power ran on a mandate of legalizing marijuana. Right now, marijuana is still illegal. Possession of marijuana is simple possession is called a summary offense. You can kind of think of that as misdemeanor in the States. It's called an absolute jurisdiction event, so only a provincial court judge can try simple possession of marijuana. The punishment remains rather small if it's under 30 grams. Notwithstanding the fact that it's illegal, my experience is the following. If you come across a fellow police officer while you happen to be out smoking marijuana, which I don't advise my clients to do, but many of them don't seem to listen to me, they get arrested. And they get brought before the court where the charge is what's called diverted. It's literally diverted out of the system. The client will offered the opportunity to do some community service work, make a charitable donation. The charge will get withdrawn. This can happen many, many times to people who are chronically possessing drugs out in public or just miraculously wrongfully accused many times, as many of my clients are. So what is going to happen is the following. Sometime before, as I understand it, July of next year, simple possession will be legalized. And that's a good thing in my respectful submission because, as I would say in court, because when I started practicing 20 years ago, I can tell you that we would spend a day in court on a contested trial over a joint of marijuana. So over 10 grams of marijuana, a judge would be paid, a prosecutor would be paid, sometimes I would be paid because you, the taxpayer, would fund me on a legal aid certificate to defend the person for a $10 joint of marijuana. And after tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes going multiple day trials, somebody might get a probation or a criminal record. It really did devastate lives because even if the person didn't go to jail, they would end up on probation with a criminal record. It would prohibit them traveling to the United States. It would prohibit them from getting certain kinds of work. And essentially, what these people were doing was just pleasure seeking. And as I wrote in the Canadian Jewish News, I firmly believe that human beings are pleasure-seeking organisms, and we can't legislate away our DNA. People commit adultery in Iran where the death penalty exists. The death penalty in many states in the United States has not decreased the crime rate, and in fact, there's very strong evidence that suggests that general deterrence doesn't work at all. So what we're going to see next year is simple possession being legalized. But the devil's really in the details. I don't know if anybody's reading any news reports, but it's really been downloaded now to the provinces to deal with. You will not be criminally charged anymore for having a marijuana joint, so to speak, but access to marijuana in terms of age, location, amounts are all going to be downloaded to the province, and it's just coming out now. We would expect nothing less. Ontario is going to be allowing any marijuana dispensaries, private dispensaries, to be in business here. They're taking all the money for themselves, as they do with the LCBO. And in fact, the LCBO is going to be managing these government dispensaries, if you will. So, how much? I got one. So, in a nutshell, the Cannabis Act is a federal piece of legislation, and that's going to govern what is criminal and what's not, and there's still a lot of prosecutorial discretion on this bone for many people to chew on. But the government it seems as though it's trying to do its best not only to decriminalize it, but monitor and govern promotional material, advertising. They have a ticketing system that they may want to roll out as well. That's my time to stop. So it's a very interesting time for us. I think this is a very positive movement in our legislation, and I'm very excited with what this government has done. Thank you.
Yes. Good evening, and I want to echo the original thanks to everybody for coming. I want to particularly note a thank you to the Rubenstein family, founders of the Beit Midrash. And I want to thank my co-panelists, who, not coincidentally, one is a past chavruta of mine and one is a current chavruta of mine, and only the best. And I also want to make sure to thank Yeshivat Or Chaim for making the room available for us. We're talking about a very practical issue, right? On Friday, Ontario issued the proposed rules, as Matthew just noted, for selling cannabis products. But even though we're dealing with a practical issue, I will stress, as I like to stress frequently, that nothing I say should be taken as psak, as a halachic ruling. That is your rabbi's headache. I'm just going to discuss the issues. If you have the source sheets, and if you don't, there are more in the back. I couldn't resist opening with an article from National Geographic from June 2015. Zeke mentioned before, Rafal, I'm not sure if it's Mechulam or Meshulam. I think it's Meshulam. But take a look at this piece. One day in 1963, a young organic chemist in Israel named Rafal Meshulam, working at the Weizmann Institute of Science outside Tel Aviv, decided to peer into the plant's chemical composition. Further testing found what the world now knows. This compound is the plant's principal active ingredient, its mind-altering essence, the stuff that makes you high. Meshulam, along with a colleague, had discovered THC. For these breakthroughs and many others, Meshulam is widely known as the patriarch of cannabis science. In 1992, you don't see that in all the emails about the wonderful things that have been discovered in Israel. I don't recall seeing that. I can't imagine why. Right. In 1992, Meshulam's quest for quantification led him from the plant itself to the inner recesses of the human brain. That year, he and several colleagues made an extraordinary discovery. They isolated the chemical made by the human body that binds to the same receptor in the brain that THC does. Meshulam named it anandamide, from the Sanskrit for supreme joy. When asked why he didn't give it a Hebrew name, he replies, quote, "Because in Hebrew there are not so many words for happiness. Jews don't like being happy." I don't... Gila, Rina, Disa, Chedva, Simcha, what? You needed an anandamide. For goodness sake. Without getting into Woody Allen territory, let's ask the question. Is it okay to take a psychoactive substance to remove inhibitions, to relax the mind, knowing that it can also intoxicate, it can also generate addiction, it can cause lifelong psychotic episodes, and so on? I'm not talking about the medical marijuana question here, and it's really important to make that distinction. There's ample basis in halacha, in Jewish law, for permitting use of psychoactive drugs to deal with pain, to deal with loss of appetite, and so on. Pain is validated in Jewish law. We are taught that pain is to be avoided. I brought you in source number 2, a piece from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, a major authority in Jewish law from the end of the 20th century, in which he argued that part of a physician's obligation in Jewish law is to mitigate pain. And this may well include not only physical pain, but psychological and emotional pain as well. And so, assuming that the studies will show that medical marijuana can relieve pain and do what it's promised to do, I think there's plenty of basis for licensing that. But it's not the topic this evening. We're talking recreational use. And so I wanted to start that piece by mentioning two responsa on the topic from the latter part of the 20th century. In 1964, the Lubavitcher Rebbe Abbey was approached about using LSD to achieve spiritual insight. I thank Adam Friedman for pointing out this response to me. And his answer was, it was a very nice answer. He said, I don't look down on anyone. I'm not negative about anything. But he said he would direct the questioner not to use LSD, but instead to try to use what he termed natural capacities to achieve spiritual heights. That's 1964 regarding LSD. 1973, Dr. Yechiel Fromm, a psychologist, approached Rav Moshe Feinstein because yeshiva boys were using this and were using marijuana, and their rebbeim, their rabbis, did not want to ask the question. They didn't want to discuss the problem. So Dr. Fromm, who told me this personally, he was actually in Toronto for a simcha last Shabbos. So Dr. Fromm said he was a psychologist and he felt the question had to be asked, and so he asked the question to Rabbi Feinstein, and Rabbi Feinstein was unequivocal in prohibiting. Interestingly, Dr. Fromm also told me that in a follow-up meeting, Rav Moshe was asked what to do with these boys who were in yeshiva who had been using the marijuana, and he said, you keep them in. The only ones he said you should remove from the yeshiva were the ones who were actually pushing it, who were selling it to others, but otherwise your responsibility is to keep them in and to keep them as students. So what are the issues that drive the Lubavitcher Rebbe saying don't use LSD, that drive Rav Moshe to say not to use marijuana, and frankly drive many others? In the research I did in preparing for this evening, I must have gone through 20 different articles. I didn't find a single one. This is a spoiler alert, but I didn't find a single one where somebody said that recreational marijuana was a good idea within Judaism. What are the concerns? So first, on a simple halachic level, two issues. Number one, self-harm. And number two, intoxication. First of all, self-harm. You already heard from Dr. Pincus, you don't need me to go through the medical issues, the various problems associated with smoking, and smoking specifically, the issues of brain development, the issue about the lifelong psychotic episodes, triggering psychological disorders, effects on one's cognitive abilities and concentration levels. All of this is established, even if there will be debate as to whether 9% of the population is immediately vulnerable to addiction, or whether it's 7% or whether it's 5%. Fundamentally, we know that there are such concerns, and that's the primary basis for prohibition in many recent halakhic articles. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 3. Most of the sources I'm going to allude to rather than read straight, because we have 7 to 10 minutes for the opening remarks. Note that to 10, not 7. 7 to 10. Yes. So in the source that I brought you in number 3, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says he's concerned about corrupting and destroying the body, and he says even if somebody will not be armed physically, it will corrupt the mind. That's his concern. Similarly, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, writing in Israel in Ma'adonai Shlomo in source number 4, says of course it's prohibited. You're not allowed to harm your body. And the list goes on of significant rabbinic figures who have spoken about this topic. Rav Ezra Batsri, Rav Ephraim Zalmanovich actually is deserving of his own comment. Rav Ephraim Zalmanovich is the rabbi of Mazkeret Batya in Israel, and he actually wrote a book called Alcoholism V'Samim B'Yahadut, Alcoholism and Drugs in Judaism. And he highlights the problem. He points out a passage in the Talmud in source number 5, which speaks about somebody smoking ketzach. Ketzach is some kind of a seed grown, as Rashi comments on the Talmud, in Arab lands. Today it's identified usually with black cumin. And it apparently has some kind of neurological impact and is used to relieve pain and depression. So the passage there in the Talmud has a problem, because one rabbi says that, you know, if you use ketzach regularly, you're never going to come to heartache. And the other one says, you know, it's one of 60 poisons, and if you sleep east of the granary where they store this stuff, you're liable for your life. And their answer is, well, it all depends. It depends on whether you smell it, I presume that means smoking it, or whether you taste it. And it'll have a different impact. And they talk about using it to bake as well. You find a familiarity. Matthew mentioned this idea goes way back about using various herbs. You see an example from the Talmud right there, and in fact they are concerned about the harm potentially associated with it. Now, the question that is always asked is, but I have heard that it's not that dangerous for everybody. To which my response is, We have a rule on Shabbos, right? We consider Shabbos to be very, very important. Shabbos is so important that if you look in the Torah, you will find capital punishment for violating Shabbos. Nonetheless, the rule is that if somebody is injured, if somebody manifests an illness at home, and they might be at risk, and we don't know. We don't know whether their life is in danger or not in danger. Maybe it's only a 10% chance that they're in danger. You know what we're supposed to do? Take them to the hospital right away. We don't hesitate. We don't ask questions. The rule is, what we call in Hebrew, safek pikuach nefesh, if it might be dangerous to life, you break Shabbos for it. So I don't really see the way somebody can say, on the one hand, I'll break Shabbos to save a life from, you know, 10%, 5% harm, and on the other hand, I'm willing to take a risk with a drug that may not harm everybody. It'll just harm some people, and maybe I'm not in the group that's going to be harmed. I think that's a difficult argument from a Jewish law perspective. The other halachic argument that comes up is regarding intoxication. Because when somebody is intoxicated, certainly if they do a good job of it, they are at risk for potentially violating various halachot, various laws. Whether that means they will be unable to fulfill religious obligations like reciting blessings, like praying, or whether it means they might actually violate prohibitions. How many stories do we need of people who are hungry? The reality is that this is a very real concern. And Rav Moshe Feinstein makes the point as well in source number 6 regarding that concern. And if someone will say, well, you know what, I was impaired at the time and therefore I'm not liable for my mistake, the answer from a Jewish law perspective is no. You're not allowed to put yourself in that position in the first place. Now, someone will say, well, then what about wine? Why do we not have that same consideration regarding wine? And the answer is, of course, we do. Rabbi Avram Danziger, author of the Chayei Adam in source number 7, talks about people who drink on Purim. And he says, a person who drinks enough on Purim that he's not going to be able to recite blessings after meals or not going to be able to pray, that person is breaking the law. We're going to talk more about wine in a couple of minutes, once I'm about 2 minutes over the time. The argument could be made that you could consume a low-level enough amount that it won't take you that far, that it won't have that dramatic an effect. My understanding, and I'll leave it to Dr. Pekas to speak to the medicine of it, but having asked him before, I feel pretty good about this response, is that whereas with alcohol, there is a possibility of being able to gauge based on the rate of consumption, based on what else you're eating, based on your body weight, there are ways that you can figure out how much you can have without putting yourself at risk. With marijuana, it's much harder to make that calculation. It has to do with the way that it's consumed. It has to do with different tolerances and different systems. And there's a much greater variation in that regard. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who I brought in source number 8, said that was why the Lubavitcher Rebbe was so opposed to drug use. He said there are all sorts of psychoactive substances. But here, it's very hard to see where the point of no return is. So from a halachic perspective, we're concerned about harming oneself, and we are concerned about putting oneself in an intoxicated position in which one will break Jewish law. From a philosophical perspective, we have problems as well. One issue is that a person is putting himself in a position where he's trying to release himself from inhibitions. But in Judaism in general, inhibitions are actually valuable. It's not something that we look to discard. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But but it's not as though we just ignore the fact that our mission as Jews is supposed to be the service of God, the fulfillment of the Torah. For a person to say, I'm going to throw that off, is actually problematic. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel makes that point in source number 10. And finally, also within the realm of the philosophical, entering into use of a known addictive substance is problematic. And again, someone will debate what percentage of people will become addicted. But Rav Moshe Feinstein includes it. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glad brings it. Rabbi Benzion Mutsafi in source number 11 is very terse in his response that putting yourself in a position in which you will become addicted to something is in and of itself philosophically problematic within Judaism. Last point, the big question, the issue of alcohol. Why is it that Judaism allows wine and even encourages the use of wine for Kiddush, for Havdalah, all sorts of special occasions, and yet is going to have a problem with intoxication and addictive substances? So I think there are three major factors to consider here. Factor number one is a practical difference. The goal of using marijuana, I think this is not going to be a surprise, is unequivocally the high. Right? I smoked marijuana because I enjoyed the smell is a sentence that nobody on this earth has ever said. It's just not true. The only goal of it is the high. Whereas with wine, there is a sense that somebody will drink a small quantity of wine for the sake of the taste and not to affect one's mind. That's number one. Number two, wine has a sacred place in Judaism in terms of the mitzvah of Kiddush, in terms of its use for special occasions, and frankly, that makes it harder to condemn wine with the same strength we will use to condemn a non-sacred substance. And that's the second point. And then the third point, Judaism does recognize value in inducing oneself to feel better, even if we don't want to go too far. And it's true with wine as well. The biblical text from Psalms, from Tehillim, in source number 13. V'yayin yisamach levav enosh, wine which gladdens the heart of man, making faces shine more than oil does. That's more than just descriptive of what wine does. It's a phrase that is meant as praise for it. It's considered to be a positive thing, making somebody joyous. Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi explained also there in source number 13, because when you are happy, it will lead to intellectual stimulation. And here I brought you source number 14. I asked Rabbi Korotkin for permission before reproducing this on the source sheet. This is an interview he gave to CJN in 2015, in which he said, a number of Talmudic passages refer to the benefits of using drugs in moderation. There's a recognition, this is the quote, even from the biblical period, that people suffer various pressures and depressions, and in order to be able to shake off some things that prevent you from fully expressing joy, it's sometimes not only permitted but mandated to indulge in small quantities of mind-altering drugs, he said. Of course, he acknowledged the Bible's references to drugs usually pertain to wine. It's unclear whether marijuana would be similarly considered. My point in quoting it is the emphasis on being in a good mood, and it's something that one can accomplish with wine. You have a way to measure how much is safe to consume. When you deal with marijuana, the measuring process is much more difficult, but even with wine, you see the concern for this. You go back to biblical text, to Tanakh, and you have story after story of people who drank too much wine as a cautionary tale. We can start with Noach and just work our way forward, you know, all the way to the Babylonian kings, to Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Persian king, Ahasuerus. The stories are legion. We have biblical laws regarding drunkenness and entering the Beit HaMikdash, entering the temple. We have various lines that moralize biblically against intoxication. When you open up the Talmud, you find sources 15 and 16, which speak about the harm that comes with wine, the harm that comes with intoxication, plays on words, various ways in which wine is considered to be harmful despite its sacred status. You find the Rambam Maimonides in the last source on the sheet, who speaks about limiting what one drinks, and he says anyone who becomes intoxicated is a sinner, degraded and destructive to his own wisdom. So the concern is there. So that when people ask the question, how could you allow wine and yet speak out against marijuana, the answer is that, first of all, wine has special status because it has sacred status historically. Wine is something one might consume without a goal of intoxication, but fundamentally the answer really is Jewish tradition has been of multiple minds regarding wine as well all along. It continues to be so. And the marijuana doesn't have the redeeming factors that the wine does. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all of our speakers on the first round. I'm sorry if that went a little bit over. It's always hard to cut your boss short. Just reminded me, so I'll allow myself the liberty of sharing a brief story, which will get me in trouble with, at some level I work for Ike Kropkin as well. My role has been inconsistent, but I'll get in trouble with him too. I had a professor in undergraduate, Peter Achenstein, a philosopher, who told me that he had a professor in Harvard, whose experience with religion highlights the danger of saying that we should encourage drug use or alcohol use in order because it allows spirituality. He said he had a professor who felt he was going to do an experiment, and he said, look, he always believed in God, because he said the purpose of religion is to make you feel good, and at that point in his life, he had never encountered an experience that made him feel as good as belief, and therefore he knew that at least from a pragmatic perspective, he believed in God. But then someone introduced him to LSD, and at that point he gave up believing in God when he realized he could recreate the experience. You can take that story for whatever you want. On that note, we'll move to our second round. And Bethany, you have the question formula as well. We'll use yours. Our second round, each of our speakers will get to address the question of harm reduction in general. So, is the legalization of marijuana a good for society, perhaps as a means of reducing levels of incarceration, as Matthew already alluded to, regulating drug use, avoiding use of harder substances, etc.? And again, I'll turn over the floor to Dr. Pacus.
So I realized after listening to Robert and Michael, that I was a little bit of a Debbie Downer on marijuana. So I was looking at Brian Schwartz, who's the chief who's the chief of Public Health Ontario, who probably recognized that I was being a little bit on the negative side, because both myself and my public health colleagues generally were quite excited about legalization and decriminalization because of sort of all the things that were mentioned, that the you know, over 500,000 Canadians have a criminal record because of marijuana possession, and over 60,000 arrests a year, and it just doesn't make an awful lot of sense. But just because you're in favor of decriminalization and legalization, which I do still think is a good idea, doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of pitfalls there. And I think that's certainly something that all of us in the public health physician community, the public health community generally, we're very much pushing for marijuana legalization and destigmatization of drug use generally, which I'll get to in a moment in terms of harm reduction. But when it actually happened, all of us really took a six-month sort of like, wow, this is a lot more complicated and challenging than we had thought. Specifically because of my work in the North, but really everyone across the country is really finding that. It is much more complicated than just, you know, it's really harmful to be incarcerating people. It's more or less harmless, which I'll most certainly acknowledge that it is more or less harmless. But at the population level, which is what public health physicians look at, there's no question that there's really some very potentially significant public health issues associated with it, which I already highlighted at the outset. But I want to talk a little bit about harm reduction. So the idea of harm reduction is that we in the public health world will say, you know what, there are certain people, there are certain populations of people who are doing at-risk behaviors, whether it be drug use or certain sexual behaviors or others, including alcohol use, and we know that we're not going to be able to stop them from engaging in those behaviors, so we can reduce the risks associated with those behaviors by doing things like needle exchange programs for injection drug users, so they don't get bloodborne infections, so that they come in to interact with health providers. We have in Toronto, we have homeless shelters where they provide alcohol every single day to those people in those homeless shelters, and it prevents them from going out on the street, getting very drunk, and potentially dying or you know, having really, really bad outcomes. That's what harm reduction is, and of course, right now, it's in the news all the time, is naloxone, which is a treatment for opioid, for the equivalent of heroin or fentanyl overdoses. You know, people are, and I've done this a number of times, even in the past couple of weeks, you just jab someone with naloxone who is going to be dead otherwise with fentanyl or another serious drug, and they pop up to life again. And we've distributed those to people around the province, to injection drug users or their friends, to use when their friends or colleagues do use these drugs. Now, there are those who would say that by providing naloxone, this antidote, or by providing alcohol to people who are homeless, or by legalizing marijuana when it wasn't otherwise legal, you're actually encouraging people to use, or you're encouraging this risk behavior. And we have good evidence certainly with opioids, with needle exchange, with naloxone, with the alcohol in shelters, that actually it really minimizes the harm to those people, and it is very good for those individuals and for the public's health. The challenge is with harm reduction when a substantial number of people in the population are using these substances. That's where the tricky thing is. We're always going to be in a situation where we're lowering barriers to care, we're lowering barriers to treatment, but when we lower barriers also to access, more people, as we said before, are going to be accessing whatever this is, and therefore more people, in theory, in harm's way, even though that harm is not necessarily going to accrue by any means to every individual. And so that's the big challenge in public health ethics that I did, 10 years of a PhD on, and still haven't gotten to a great conclusion, which is why I'm still learning through Rabbi Tortina and Rabbi Friedman in the back there, with how do you actually balance harms to populations or benefits to certain populations and harms to other populations. So you're certainly benefiting those marginalized and vulnerable people who have a criminal record or would have a criminal record, who are heavy users or who simply just want to use and who don't have that liberty or that access right now, with the potential harms that are accrued to entirely different people. How do you balance those things, and how do you balance those things over time? So I have no doubt that if we actually took the Saudi Arabian perspective on alcohol, that we would have far less motor vehicle accidents and far less morbidity and mortality related to alcohol in the short term. There's no doubt. But as we all know from Prohibition in the 20s, although we can't really extrapolate everything until today, that just doesn't work in our society, and we would have a whole criminal enterprise and lots of bad stuff going on. So how do you actually balance potentially saving lives over the short term with prohibition, with causing a great deal, potentially great, even more harm, but over the longer term, when those harms are potentially quite uncertain. And I want to just, before I end, mention that I do think that the legislation that was proposed by the Ontario government last Thursday, Friday, was actually a very good balance of that. They really did listen to all the public health experts, whether Public Health Ontario or across the country, with respect to many, many things, including keeping it under the LCBO. There are certainly risks associated with the government actually handing out substances like that, in terms of everyone feeling that, well, if the government's giving it out, then it's certainly legitimate. But when you have it in the hands of private, entrepreneurs, and you have that aggressive marketing, there's a whole other side that is quite problematic. And there's quite a bit of other bits of that legislation, including making sure that youth, not only can you not sell it to youth, but they can't possess it. That's really something very important. But actually, when we look at the North, when we look at Northwest Territories in Alaska, youth were not allowed to possess it, whereas none of what they were, and we think that some of those differences could in use and harms could be attributed to that. So that was probably a good thing, although there's a whole bunch of criminalizing and potentially incarcerating or taking stuff away from youth that's problematic as well. So that harm reduction bit is really, really challenging, how to actually balance things on the individual and population level and over short periods versus long periods, something that's really not clear, whether it be in public health, in law, and I think in halakha as well. It's an area that needs a lot of thought and reflection.
Thank you. So the legislation, the Cannabis Act, the purposes, which are stated at the beginning, say the following. The purposes of the legislation are to protect the health of young persons by restricting their access to cannabis. B, protect young persons and others from inducements to use cannabis. C, provide for the illicit production of cannabis to reduce illicit activities in relation to cannabis. D, deter illicit activities in relation to cannabis through appropriate sanctions and enforcement measures. E, reduce the burden on the criminal justice system in relation to cannabis. F, provide access to a quality-controlled supply of cannabis and enhance public awareness of the health risks associated with cannabis use. Some of the harm reduction arguments I don't really think have much merit, to be frank with you. Does anybody really think that anybody who wants to smoke marijuana today is not doing it? Everybody has access to marijuana today. And my concern is that the provincial legislation won't be able to legally supply the demand for marijuana as it exists today. Because as I read it, there's only going to be some 40 outlets, small outlets for the entire province.
Plus online.
Plus online. Right? So one harm reduction argument that does have carry some weight with me is that hopefully it will have it will create some sort of measured and legal potency, because there's all sorts of different kinds of marijuana on the street right now, laced with everything that you can possibly imagine and things that you even can't. Certainly, deterring organized crime is, in my opinion, a very valid purpose. I can't tell you how much crime and violence and destruction organized crime perpetrates on our culture and society because of the criminalization of many drugs, including marijuana. I agree with Dr. Pacus. There's some 500,000 people who've been turned into criminals over the years because of this drug. And I'm going to limit my comments to this drug and not try and go off the path to other drugs. But in my, it's my firm belief that the war on drugs, that as we've waged it in the last 40 to 50 years, is a colossal failure. I don't think that many people would dispute that, but in 2016, the authors of the John Hopkins Lancet Commission on the Public Health and International Drug Policy called for minor use, possession, and petty use to be decriminalized following measurably worsened human health, and they concluded that the war on drugs has been a failure. Canada, just to give you a little bit of numbers to put this all in the context, Canada's incarceration rate is 114 people per 100,000, which is actually quite low. We do not incarcerate people in the same way the United States does. Some numbers in the United States have their incarceration rate over 600 persons per 100,000. But essentially, for many, many decades, the crime control argument has been rather cyclical, which are drugs are bad, they cause crime, and we need more money to fight the crime that drugs cost. And unfortunately, this never gets any better. It always gets worse. It's unusual that I think this year is the first year that the Toronto police budget has actually decreased ever. But I think it's exceeded over $1 billion for this city alone. I heard a statistic, actually, in terms of failure to combat drug crime in particular, that only 3% of drugs coming through Pearson, according to Interpol, are actually stopped. So my point being that we've lost this war, that we, in my submission, so to speak, we never should have started in the first place. You know, it costs us as a taxpayer $117,000 a year to incarcerate one person in jail. Just think about that. That's a colossal amount of money. Most people don't make that money in a year, and we're paying to incarcerate those people. We should look to jurisdictions like Portugal, who have decriminalized and legalized small possessions of drugs. Another place to look at, if you're interested in what's going on, is the state of Washington in Colorado. They legalized small marijuana possession in the last few years, and they just came out with a statistic that their youth have not increased their use whatsoever. Their legislation, I believe, is different to ours, but there are a number of arguments for harm reduction. One is that the criminal courts are overburdened. They are. There's no question they are. I'm there every day. They're backlogged. Some people, I'm sure you've heard of the case called Regina versus Jordan that's come out from the Supreme Court of Canada, where cases are now getting thrown out because of presumptive unreasonable delay of 18 months. Our courts are certainly overtaxed. As I said, organized crime is a big problem. Anything that we can do to take away their teeth in terms of taking away their business, I'm all in favor for. The potency argument I think is a fair one. I've also heard that marijuana is a gateway drug and that we should legalize it and that somehow this will prevent people from using harder drugs. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen because I haven't done any empirical research on it, but I've never had a heroin addict tell me, you know, Matthew, I smoked a joint and it just led me down a path to injecting heroin. I've just never heard that. And I'm not saying it hasn't happened. I'm just saying that I think this whole gateway notion has been used by us and our governments for many years to criminalize something that should never have been criminalized in the first place. Ultimately, this utilitarian argument of harm reduction, while interesting, I don't really see it as the main issue, although I'm engaging you with it because that's what I've been told to do. I see this as a principle. And the principle is really this. Should an adult be told what they can and can't do by their government when they're not hurting anybody? It's really as simple as that. Again, I'm not saying that marijuana doesn't cause violence. I don't know. I haven't done empirical research on it. I just know from my anecdotal journey of 20 years, I've seen very few people beat their wives who smoke joints. I've seen very few people murder people who smoked marijuana. I've seen many people beat their wives because they got too drunk, and I've seen many people commit homicide because of alcohol. So, to me, if somebody is engaging in a relatively, and I want to stress, relatively harmless endeavor by getting high, and they're not hurting anybody, why is your government telling you you can't do it? And for me, it's really a matter of principle. And why have we criminalized people who are doing nothing other than leaving you alone and doing what they want to do? So for me personally, this is really a matter, a philosophical principle issue, and not a utilitarian one. However, I think there's more than enough arguments to go around that harm reduction certainly does justify the current legislation that's going to be brought into force next year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. You know, between Matthew and Barry, they talked about all the positives and harm reduction, but nobody mentioned that the online shipping will also save Canada Post. So the fundamental question that's being asked here regarding harm reduction, I want to frame it in terms of Jewish law as opposed to the secular system. And I want to speak briefly because I really want to make sure we get to the third round, which is about the Jewish community. But the fundamental ethical conundrum, we're trying to help a large group of people by allowing users a softer drug and fighting criminal organizations which make money from illegal drugs. At the same time, we are introducing a non-identical group of people into harm's way. If they should have issues of addiction, if they should have issues of psychotic episodes, if they should have issues of brain development, lung damage from smoking, and so on. So you've saved a lot of people from one harm, and you've committed other people to a potential harm. And the question is fundamentally, ethically, is this an okay thing to do? So the answer is maybe. Meaning, within Judaism, we have a basis for making that kind of argument. We have a principle of mutav sheyu shogegin, better for people to sin accidentally rather than sin intentionally. And so Moshe Feinstein dealt with a fascinating question. The question was this. You're in shul. It's Rosh Hashanah. We're not supposed to speak during shofar. And the question is, do you announce in shul reminding people don't speak during shofar? Because there are a few people who will hear that and remember, oh wait, I shouldn't speak, and therefore they will remember that they shouldn't speak. But on the other hand, there are a bunch of people who, not in those who daven here, not in those who daven in your shul, fine, but there are people out there, hypothetically, who will hear the announcement and ignore it, and now they will be intentionally violating the law. And so the question is, do you save people? Do you say, let's not make the announcement, in order to save people from becoming intentional sinners, knowing that means that it's going to cause some people to sin accidentally? And the answer actually may well be, you have to see Rabbi Feinstein's discussion of the issue and all the sides, but the answer may well be, yeah, don't make the announcement. save these people from sinning intentionally at the expense of those who will now sin accidentally. So there is a harm reduction philosophy that you can find. Now, that may not be the perfect analogy to our case, but is actually an even stronger example that can be brought, and that's the issue of ransoming hostages. The Talmud deals with this as a very live, active question. When hostages are taken, and the hostage takers demand a ransom, some exorbitant sum. So the question is, do we pay the exorbitant sum in order to ransom the people who are being held, knowing that it provides an incentive for the hostage takers to take more hostages? And the answer is that assuming the current hostages' lives are not in immediate danger, then yeah, we say don't pay the ransom. Let them be held as hostage. So in other words, we will allow the current hostages to be held in order to save prospective victims in the future. So there is a concept of harm reduction. We could debate in and out of whether the cases are entirely similar. You can make the argument that the marijuana use case is entirely different. You can make that argument because, after all, here the people we're trying to save are doing something which we've argued already halacha does not permit. So maybe there's an argument of I don't need to save them from their problems. They're already breaking the law anyway. The question of whether the analogy truly follows is a good one. But the fundamental point that I want to make is, having been, to borrow from Dr. Pacus, Debbie Downer, regarding recreational marijuana use, in my first point, I have to acknowledge that the concept of harm reduction has its place within Judaism, and the specifics of who am I harming, who am I helping, what are the ratios, and what are the ways to minimize it, and will the harm reduction actually work? Those are all points that need to be discussed, but fundamentally, it is an acceptable idea in general within Judaism.
Okay, so we're going to try to keep the next round to 5-minute comments each, so we'll have some... What? Each? Or shorter. Shorter if you want is fine. So we'll have some time for questions and Mariv and get you out about 9 o'clock. So for the final round... focusing now on the Jewish community specifically... we've talked a bit about the problems for the general society and the potential problems that are being solved with the legalization of recreational marijuana use. But now turning inward, the question is, with marijuana becoming legal and readily accessible, what should parents, employers, institutions within the Jewish community be thinking about and doing to make sure that we respond properly as Canada rolls out its new legislation?
Thank you. So I'll try to be very brief. And I'll just start with a couple of responses to some of the things that Matthew said. With respect to people, to marijuana as a gateway drug, I see that actually all the time. Is I don't see people coming into the Emerge as much with cannabis issues, although they certainly do in Nunavut. I see people, and when I work in Northern Ontario in Emerges, and I have a lot of time overnight to spend chatting with people, and I see talk to people whose marijuana use led to opioid use. All the time, not the folks who started using because of prescription opioids, but the same dealer for marijuana was often the same dealer for the opioids. So in fact, that's an argument for legalization in the sense that you're separating those two things now, so that you may actually find that marijuana is a bit less of a gateway drug because the same dealer that's getting you the marijuana is not suggesting something even more addictive to you. There's both sides to that as well. But fundamentally, when talking about the Jewish community, marijuana use, like any substance use and many other things in public health, it's not about the substance itself. It's not even
even how it's used, although in some ways it is. It's really a social phenomenon. So it's about what the substance is and how it's used, but it's who it's used with, what it's used with, what is the social context around it. And that's what really determines how it's going to be used in the many different communities that make up the Jewish community. So Center for Addiction and Mental Health and a group out in BC have actually looked at how many new users are they expecting in Canada, you know, with a simple question of if marijuana becomes legal, would you use it? And the number was, the lowest number was around 900,000, so about 1 million new users. And that's because there actually are, and maybe Matthew doesn't encounter these people in your criminal defense practice, but there are lots of people who just don't use it because it's illegal. Like, there are lots of people like that who adhere very closely to the law from all kinds of different reasons, and the only thing that really is stopping them from doing something that would otherwise be reasonable is that it is illegal. It's not everyone by any means, but there is a certain group of people. So I think we know that we will see quite a few new users, and you know, that is what it is. And we will see lots of new users in the Jewish community, in different communities for different reasons. When I was in high school, I didn't use alcohol, I didn't use tobacco, I didn't use any kind of drugging because that was the social community that I was in, at CHAT. There certainly were people who used, and that just none of my friends or myself did. That was just the way it was because of that social grouping. You do go, for this audience, I think it's reasonable to say, you know, you can go to wedding halls sometimes and you can see a secular wedding on one side and a religious wedding on the other side, and coming out of the religious wedding are a whole whack of people who are smoking cigarettes outside, and the people from the secular wedding are like, what is going on? That you know, it's very much, very contextual. It's different. Ashkenazi, Sephardi is different in different, you know, given that we're pretty small, in some ways our social groupings are small, and there can be, you know, dramatic differences. When my kids see a Haredi guy, a man in Israel smoking, their first reaction is like, Abba, did you see there's a Jew smoking? Because that's just not something they'd encountered in the past. Whereas when we went up to Meron for Lag BaOmer, huge numbers of Haredi men. Thankfully, my daughters don't remember that. But there's a tremendous social phenomenon around tobacco use, and I write prescriptions for Ventolin for my friends of mine who have boys who are in yeshivas in Lakewood because they've got asthma and they're chavrusas or smokers, and that's just, I mean, in my med school class or my social group, that just wouldn't happen at all. So it's very contextual. You know, I'm not painting a good picture of the firm community, but that's very, you know, I mention it because it is surprising to me and to others. I'll mention one little other anecdote that has to do with it has to do with ham, in that there was an interesting outbreak of Salmonella munchen, which is a particular type of salmonella that was associated with, that they thought was associated with ham consumption around the United States, but there were different manufacturers of the ham, and they couldn't figure out where the salmonella was coming from, but it was all young people who seemed to be falling ill, and in the end, maybe many of you have heard of this, in the end they did find, there was my understanding is, and it's anecdotal, there were a couple of Jews that were also in there that wouldn't have been eating the ham, and they found out actually that it was from marijuana that had been tainted with salmonella, that they actually got the salmonella from that, so there was a little sort of Jew connection to it. Some outbreak investigations. I think I'll leave my last comments.
Yeah. I think a brief announcement, I think just to make sure that we get to the questions quickly. If people have questions, if you could write them down now so that Adam and Yaron can bring it to me, so I'll start sifting through them. So as soon as we finish this round, we can turn to a few of the questions and I'll have time to just sort through it. So, Matthew.
In terms of the Jewish community, you know, I think what might be, and I'm not trying to take away from Dr. Pacis's experience and whether marijuana is a gateway drug or not, and whether your drug dealer is a pusher or a dealer, I'll leave it to you and Dr. Pacis and other experts to consider whether Nunavut is an analogous population and community, and whether we should be extrapolating that onto us. But I've done a little bit more research and reading about Colorado and Washington. I can tell you there that in the first year of legalization, that they, with not their youth but their adult population, increased consumption by 22% in 2012 and 2013. So it's a considerable amount. I don't know how British Columbia has extrapolated their numbers of a million users. But in my thinking, I answer that by saying, so what? I mean, so what if that is the case? The Jewish community, this is not a Jewish issue. And I don't think that the Jewish community is necessarily going to have a uniquely Jewish response to marijuana legalization. Forest Hill kids, York Mill kids, Chad kids will continue to smoke marijuana as they do and probably will in the future. And whether they get it from the internet, an LCBO licensed facility, or a drug dealer on the street, hopefully not. They will continue to do that, and our community will have to deal with that with whatever levels of addiction. I understand from Dr. Pacus and my own research is 9%, whatever levels of addiction that may be. Again, one thing that concerns me as a parent is whether or not children are going to have enough access to legal marijuana, or whether they're going to have to go out onto the street and use a dealer, because that's not what we want for a variety of social reasons. But I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the future holds. I would like to think that, frankly, this may be much ado about not so much, and that life will go on, and the sky is not going to fall, and this is not going to be an epidemic or a pandemic plaguing our communities and our culture, and we won't have a lackadaisical society, and it won't be the decline of the Western civilization because we've legalized marijuana. There are certainly issues that go that need some thought in terms of being on the job and employers. As an employer, I can tell you, if somebody shows up high to my law firm, I would react the same way if they showed up drunk. It's unacceptable, and they'd be sent home and perhaps fired. I mean, it's just... I'm not trying to be have a lack of nuance here, but we can treat marijuana in a very similar way that we treat alcohol. Indeed, that's how we're treating drinking and being high, as opposed to drinking or like drinking and driving. One thing parents might want to consider is how are parents going to have that conversation with children now? Are parents going to talk about marijuana in a way that they talk to them about alcohol? It's legal. Or are they going to continue to have that kind of drug conversation and lump marijuana in with cocaine and heroin and all those other harder drugs? That's something to consider. Are institutions and Jewish institutions, when and if they could get a marijuana license like you can get a liquor license for a bar mitzvah or a wedding, how are they going to deal with it? I'm quite serious. I mean, what's to stop us having a wedding and having a vaporizer room instead of a liquor bar? I don't know. I don't have the answer to these questions, but these are kinds of the things that people are going to have to contend with moving into the future. I think that we should always be guided by our rabbis and always be guided by halakha and always be guided by common sense and reason. I don't, as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm always slagging the government, not really coming to its rescue. But there's been a lot of thought and research put into what is happening, and there's still a lot of debate and input, submissions and written material being put into how things are going to unfold. This is just the first reading of the Cannabis Act. What you'll see online now may not be what you see a year from now. People are still considering things and seeing how they're going to unfold. But certainly, moving forward, we should all, as parents, brothers and sisters and friends and participants in this community, give some serious thought to how we're going to address these issues as we move forward.
So, first I would say that this is already a real problem, and when I say this, I mean the issue of addiction within the Jewish community. It's an issue that, unfortunately, many are in denial regarding. Dr. David Palkowitz likes to tell the story about a campaign against shul kiddush clubs, and how there was a particular shul president who, when confronted with the request to ban the kiddush club, had no patience for it, wanted nothing to do with it, and wouldn't even give it a hearing. And then he went out to a basketball game with his kids, and he saw some rowdy fans who clearly had had too many beers. And he thought he would use that opportunity to teach his son a lesson about alcohol. See what they're doing. You know, that's the danger for you. And his son said, that's actually what you and your friends look like when you come back from Musaf. And at that point, the president was a lot more willing to hear the conversation about kiddush clubs. It's a reality. I mean, you know, we have, I'm glad he's here, David Kaufman from JAX here, and he can tell it to you far better than I can. But as was mentioned in my bio in the beginning, I was involved with the group that started a JAX chapter in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We hosted the meetings in our shul, and I went, and I heard what was being said. These are real issues in our communities, and even if the sky isn't falling in hundreds and thousands or whatever, one is too many, because that's a family that's dealing with a parent, a child, whatever, who is addicted or is stuck with psychotic episodes or whatever it's going to be. I think one is too many. And we do have a special vulnerability in this regard. We're subject to the same stresses and weaknesses as society at large. You know, in an ideal world, Judaism would fulfill people's needs for happiness and meaning. Great. Let me know when we get there. But our community also faces cultural problems, which is that any close-knit ethnic community, including denial that we share the ills of general society, social stigma associated with drug addiction, it makes treatment much more difficult. We've seen it already, and now we're just adding. What steps do we need to take? Well, it's a lot easier to borrow an Americanism. It's easier to be Paul Revere than to be George Washington. To sound the alarm and say the British are coming is much simpler than proposing solutions. But I would say the following. Rabbi Dr. Twersky is fond of pointing out that we need to become better parents, teachers, and leaders, creating a society in which people don't feel the needs and pain that often drive people to drugs and alcohol. Another element for the community to be proactive and on the alert, as opposed to waiting for this to become a problem. I think we need professional training for synagogue rabbis, teachers, camp, youth group leadership in recognizing dysfunction and acting on it. I think that in terms of organizations like JAX, and I mentioned JAX as the one that I'm most familiar with, perhaps there are others involved as well, I think they need mainstream support. I think we have a situation in the community, and it's not just the Jewish community, in which there are certain institutions which everybody supports. Schools, maybe an example, whether they use the school or not, hopefully they're supporting the schools within the community. And then you have other institutions which are sort of niche market, and they'll get support from people who have been touched by them specifically, by their needs, where something happens in somebody's family, and now they're going to support. And I think that's a real mistake when you're talking about this particular need. Just like people who don't have children in schools still support the schools, or people who are past the age of mikvah will still support the mikvah, I think the community should see mental health organizations as deserving of mainstream support.
Okay, so we're going to Qualmar for 9, so we have about 10 minutes or so, a little bit more for questions. So we had a few questions which were primarily directed, I think, each of them at one speaker, but I'll open them up. I handed them out to the speakers. I'm going to start actually with Matthew. One question of it is, I think, primarily for Matthew, was that you've been very open about your support for legalization, a bit of a libertarian perspective. Do you the sort of trend in Canada and the States has been to really crack down on tobacco use in public spaces and the like, and now we're opening up a new venue of smoking marijuana. Do you see a tension in the fact that we're being more strict on tobacco use while simultaneously being less strict and opening up an entire new host of potential problems with marijuana use? So anyone can answer, but I think that was directed primarily at Matthew.
I tell my wife that the art of living is learning to live with contradiction. And is it contradictory? In a way, yes. I mean, there's a difference between promoting marijuana use and decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana use. I don't think anybody, and if you read the Cannabis Act, it's very clear they have a lot of legislation around advertising, promotion, not promoting lifestyle, enhancing lifestyle advertisements with marijuana. Nobody's trying to promote marijuana and encourage people to take it up. I want to be really clear about that. In fact, I think some of the vaping businesses now will not be allowed to continue advertising as of next year. And I saw on the back of a bus, actually, that they were giving out discounts if you responded to a vape ad before July 2018. So nobody's promoting the use of marijuana. I think in an ideal world, Dr. Pankus and I would agree, nobody should be smoking it. Nobody should be using any mind-altering substances. We'd all just be really naturally happy. I really mean that. Nobody should be smoking cigarettes either. They're not good for you. They're really bad. They kill people. I smoked for 24 years. I know. But at the same time, there's a tension because grown adults should be allowed to do whatever they want to do, even if it means making really stupid decisions. I mean, stupidity isn't against the law, unfortunately. Or maybe it should be. I don't know. Should people stand 9 meters away from a hospital when they're smoking? Yeah, I can see a reason for that. Nobody wants to inhale secondhand smoke. That seems reasonable. At the same time, nobody's promoting smoking cigarettes. So I think if anything, this legislation is starting to be aligned. You'll see the liquor companies can't advertise anymore the way they used to. Tobacco companies can't advertise the way they, and sponsor things the way they used to. And I don't think you're going to see marijuana companies be allowed to advertise and promote lifestyle the way that they would like to. I think what this legislation does is recognize probably an unnecessary evil of human beings, and at the same time, not try and promote it.
I'd like to comment on that one, just because the issue of whether an adult should be able to do whatever they want to do just because they want to do it, as long as it doesn't harm anyone else, there's two pieces of that. One, that may not be true on the face of it. It certainly isn't from a halachic perspective, but Rabbi Turchiner maybe can speak to that. And the idea that it doesn't harm anyone else is from a public health perspective complete. That literally never happens. We don't have to talk about helmet laws and seatbelt laws, where the helmet laws have gone off in the U.S. I mean, orders of magnitude more people have died of motorcycling injuries, among other things, including people who were not on those motorcycles themselves and families affected. In the law, I can incarcerate someone who has TB if they refuse treatment, according to Section 35 of the Health Promotion and Protection Act, without the involvement of a lawyer or a judge. Well, a judge is involved, but those are powers that are given to public health physicians, medical officers of health, specifically to protect the public from the actions of individuals. Sometimes those actions are pretty extreme, like someone running around with extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis, and other times those actions are as simple as lighting up a cigarette where someone might want to, including in their own home if it seeps into someone else's house that might be sensitive to it. So we do a lot of health promotion stuff, and public health, and we don't like to be heavy-handed these days, but that is our job. We're responsible for the health of the population. So when 1,000 people are dying of opioids on the street, that's actually a lota modo damreja for us as public health specialists, and we need to do something, and almost always that is going to involve restricting liberties somehow, and we try to do it to the extent that the renormalization of smoking and tobacco use is with this legislation is absolutely huge. So getting people in, whether it's in movies or just around town, wherever, smoking again, no matter what that is, renormalizing that activity such that people are going to start tobacco smoking again. That has been shown to happen in Colorado. That's been shown to happen in a number of places, including in the Netherlands, and that is a huge, huge problem. There aren't a lot of ways that we can actually constructively, you know, deal with that, but we're doing our best to mitigate it through legislation.
There were some specifics of dangers. I actually want to pose a question, which I think will be for Barry and or Richard Sheener. It'll be a double. You can take it. Some of you may know, though I doubt most of you know, that health policy is not something I've ever done professionally. I just grew up on it. My mother is an epidemiologist with a master's in public health. Has been working in the field for 35 years, so it's something that I've grown up with. One of the things my mother does, it's not what she's originally trained for, but she's sort of formed this position, is act as sometimes a liaison with the Hasidic community, because my mother speaks Yiddish and knows enough halakha, she can talk to them. And one of the struggles that there is, and we talked about dealing with this in the Jewish community, is how do you communicate the values and the dangers from a public health perspective to a from community when, for the most part, people involved in public health don't know the lingo, the language, the values of the from community. The question I pose to both of you is, we've talked a lot about the ways that we can reduce harm as we roll out this legislation, and the potential dangers the from community will shape. How would you think we should go about communicating the dangers and offering advice to the from community in a way that will speak to not just the public health risk, but will resonate from a Jewish value perspective and really be true to their experience such that it'll affect them? So either of you can take that question.
I'm taking the liberty as moderator to ask the question.
I don't have a good answer. When you look at Mises of the Pen, herpes simplex virus, encephalitis, how to actually communicate those risks to the particular communities in the U.S.
Does anyone need a microphone or
recording purpose? Anyway, that is very, very challenging. And the only way that I know how to do it is as somebody who's a from public health person, one of only two, I think, in Ontario. The other one has left the room. was sitting right there. We are the liaisons, and in a place where there isn't anyone, then it's a huge problem. I can tell you that the measles outbreak in the Haredi community in the U.S., the U.K., and Israel, we have listservs that go out to the whole planet, 15,000 infectious disease people and governments around the world. And when it says on there that there are anti-vaccine groups that have a wedding, first of all, of 2,000 people in the U.K., all of my colleagues are like, what is that, a wedding of 2,000 people, right? But that's a Hasidic wedding. But it is a horrible Chilul Hashem. So actually, one of the things that I found most useful is the Chilul Hashem argument. But there's not a lot else that I found that works very well. Having smicha sometimes helps.
This is fundamentally a problem. The Mitzitza B'Peh case of it is certainly a good example. This is an easier fight than that one, though, for two reasons. Number one, because no one, I think, is arguing that using marijuana is a mitzvah. I'm ready to be proven wrong. But that's number one. Yes,
14.
I wasn't going to say that. And then number two, the fact that really, I went through a solid 20 different authors on the topic, 15 to 20 different authors, and not one of them permitted it. I think fundamentally, the only way that this gets into a community, the message is going to get into a community like that, is if their leaders are saying it, and they are. They are saying it. I think when the Shaila is asked, and the answer is no, you create that. the environment of this is not socially acceptable, which Barry was talking about before. I think that's the only way that this works. But I think it should work because there isn't the incentive, there isn't a religious incentive for using it. So hopefully they crack down, and they crack down effectively in order to limit it.
Okay,
I think we're at 9 o'clock. Thank you so much for coming.